Hello and welcome to another episode of the IEA podcast. I'm Emily Carver, Media Manager at the Institute of Economic Affairs. In this episode, I speak to three of the leading voices around free speech and academic freedom, Eric Kaufman, Joanna Williams and Radomir Talcoat, about how we can support viewpoint diversity in our universities. If you're new, don't forget to subscribe. We're available on Podbean, Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And make sure you're signed up to our weekly newsletter for all our latest commentary, analysis and events. Thanks for listening. Hi everyone. So Eric, if I may start with you, you recently co-authored a report for Policy Exchange which looked at academic freedom in the UK. You argued that academic freedom is being undermined in a way that departs from this country's liberal democratic traditions. Could you start by maybe setting the scene? Why should we even be concerned at the state of freedom in our universities?
Well, clearly the most obvious manifestation of the problem are the sort of spate of no platformings and dismissals. So, you know, we know about a lot of these high-profile media things, the Jordan Peterson fellowship being rescinded, Germaine Greer, etc., and perhaps more recently, people, including conservative MPs. These are just manifestations, I think, of a rising problem. But I think what our report talks about very much is that what you see on the surface, the no platformings and the dismissal campaign, this is very much the tip of an iceberg. And it's actually not the most important threat to academic freedom. It's what you don't see. It's what you don't see in terms of hiring, promotion, in terms of bullying of colleagues, disciplinary procedures, all kinds of threats that may not even be carried out, which shape the threat perceptions and the chill, the perceptions of a climate of hostility and chill, not for everybody. So academic freedom isn't a problem for 90%. Well, maybe not 90, but for a very large majority of academics, this isn't going to be a problem. In their teaching and their research, they're not going to notice anything. They're swimming with a current, and it won't be apparent to them. It's only going to be apparent to especially about 1 in 10 academics who are conservative, leave-supporting, or gender-critical. That group of academics are going to feel these pressures immensely. So what that means is they're not going to do research that's going to cross certain lines. And those lines are not particularly radical lines, but they're just lines that might mean it's harder to get published, you won't get promoted, you might be seen as deviating from what it means to be a good colleague, all of these subtle things. What that means is it really shuts down dissent within the academy and leads to a kind of groupthink. So that we pointed out in the report very much some of the statistics, some of the numbers, because it's very often you'll get the opponents who will say, well, look, this is just a few incidents. It's a right-wing hysteric narrative. It doesn't actually really exist. It's not a problem. What we tried to do was put hard numbers onto the scope and the lower part of the iceberg that isn't really visible and just how massive a problem this really is.
As you say, there are a number of academics and people, you know, in just wider society who want to diminish this problem because it doesn't hit them themselves. And I imagine it's rather hard to measure exactly how someone's success might have been impeded in the academic world. So how did you actually put together these figures and what statistics did you look at?
Right. So first of all, you can't just sample academics by doing an opinion poll because no polling firm will have more than, at the most, a few hundred. However, YouGov has the largest, YouGov in this country, in the UK, has the best panel of respondents. It's over half a million respondents of any Western country. And what that means is that there happen to be over 1,000 university lecturers and professors in that half a million or so panel. And that gives us the best opportunity to get a random sample of academics, what they think, what their politics are, what their views are on academic freedom. And so we came up with the largest sample, representative type sample ever, randomly drawn, 820 academics. Now, 40% of these were retired, but of course, the average age there is about 70. Many of them would still have connections to their departments. their views did not differ from those of the active academics. So we have a sample of 820. What we saw was, for example, if you take the social sciences and humanities academics, only 30% of social science humanities academics said someone who supported leave in the Brexit referendum would be comfortable expressing that view to a colleague. And amongst the smaller group of leave supporters, that's below 20% who say they would be comfortable. So 80% of those leave supporting academics are either unsure or, for the vast majority of them, uncomfortable. Now, I will say the only thing that could make that number look not so bad is that I've done a sort of study in the U.S. that shows that amongst Trump-supporting academics, it's even lower. So, okay, that's a kind of one number.
Are there any?
There are very few. It's about 4 or 5%. But anyway, that's so one thing we see is that there is this very large chill effect, not for everybody, as I say, but only for, we had about 16% leave supporters in our sample. When you narrow it to social sciences and humanities, it's about 10%. So about 1 in 10 academics supported leave. Roughly, that is the share that is conservative. And it is that group where you're seeing this very large chill effect. For everybody else, it's very minimal. But for that group, a very strong chill effect. So they don't feel they can express their views. More importantly, we asked, you know, do you experience a hostile climate for your political beliefs? And there it's about 1 in 2 of leave or conservative supporting social science humanities academics. Again, a bit lower than in the U.S. where it's like 75%. But still, if 1 in 2 say they experience a hostile climate, that's telling us that there's a massive effect. Now, of course, you might say, well, this is just perception. This is really where I think it's important to look at the question of discrimination. So we actually asked people if they would discriminate against a known leave supporter in hiring and also against conservatives in grant applications, in refereeing papers. Now what you see, and we used a method called the List Experiment, which allows us people to conceal their individual views, but then allows us to see what the number is collectively. And it's explained in the report, it's a well-established technique. What we essentially showed was about 1 in 3 academics would discriminate against a known leave supporter in hiring. So the problem here is, now you could say, well, 2 in 3 academics would not discriminate, but the problem is 1 in 3, when you have a panel of 3 or 4 that are doing the hiring, when you have a room full of 30 that are listening to a job presentation, all of a sudden the chance of being discriminated against is almost
certain.
And now the other point we make is, look, the right also discriminates against the left. But when you've only got less than 1 in 10 on the right, that discrimination is going to have almost no effect. In fact, discrimination in favor of the left by the left is going to almost cancel that out. Whereas discrimination by the left, since the left is 3/4 roughly of, or somewhere on the order of, you know, 2/3 or so of the department, then their discrimination is going to have a massive effect on the outcome. And so it's not so much that the left discriminates more than the right. They both equally discriminate, but there's so many more leftists that the net impact on a known conservative or leave supporter is massive. So again, 1 in 3 academics, not just left-wing academics, of all academics surveyed would discriminate against a known leaver. And we estimate it's a little bit higher for discriminating on a grant application. So if you put, these are hard numbers now, and also I should finally add that this is about the 4th study that has shown exactly the same thing, at roughly the same level of discrimination, roughly the same level of experiencing a hostile environment. These are quantitative, peer-reviewed studies. And so to deny this, as some academic activists have on Twitter, is, in my view, just flat earthism. It's just science denial. And so the problem is, how do we then move from this very clear evidence of discrimination, chill effects, hostility? And the problem is, that leads people to self-censor. So when we talk about academic freedom, the big threat is, you know that you're going to be discriminated against if you actually express yourself, and so you self-censor. And it's that, what Mill calls the despotism of custom, that's really at work driving the bigger problem of academic freedom, not just the no platformings.
I wonder, Eric, could I just ask a question myself on that point?
I wonder if there's perhaps an even more drastic form of self-censorship that can't necessarily be picked up statistically yet, which is that apart from discrimination in hiring, lots of academics or some academics who are, for example, Eurosceptics, consider themselves conservatives and so on, will leave the university sector relatively early in their career and carry out, if you like, the most drastic form of self-censorship, which is simply completely silencing themselves as an academic or going into maybe another non-university field working at a more tolerant think tank, for example. Do you think that's going on?
I'm pretty sure that is. I mean, I don't have the hard evidence necessarily to know that we have a pool prior to entering, say, doctoral work, and that those people are consciously not entering PhD programs. But we have now got evidence pretty strongly of very widespread political discrimination. So it's absolutely the case that a conservative who thinks they will be discriminated, well, they're actually correct. So it's kind of rational for them to either hide their views or to leave the profession entirely. What is very hard to know is to what extent the fact that those who identify as on the right are less than 1 in 10 social science humanities academics, is that because people have self-selected because of their out of academia, or is it because of this overt discrimination? And that's very tricky to know. We can look at other professions, incidentally, which didn't necessarily make it into the report. If you look at teachers, with PhDs or people in other fields with PhDs, they are also relatively left-wing and remain voting. But there's something like a 10-20-point difference between those professions and academia. And so it could be the case, in fact, that what you say is correct.
That's interesting.
Sorry, can I bring in Joanna, just because she's been sitting there so for a while. Joanna, you're not on the right. So what areas have you noticed being restricted in academia? And is it just fair to say it's just a numbers game? Has it always been like this? Has it always been that academia has been more left-wing oriented? So is the only way to fix this simply for more conservatives or people with different views to just join academia?
Okay, so to take some of those points in a slightly random order from the order in which you asked them. First of all, in terms of has it always been like this, I mean, I would go back to one of the comments that you made in your introductory remarks where you say, how can we get universities to once again be bastions of free speech? And at risk of being a bit pessimistic, I'm not convinced they ever were bastions of free speech. I think if we look at the entire history of universities, it's very difficult to identify a kind of golden age where both at the level of the institution and at the level of the individual academic, there was this culture of complete free speech and freedom of intellectual inquiry. I think the problem that we've got is that throughout the history of universities, the threats to free speech have changed over time. So if you go right back to the very beginnings, the threat to free speech would actually come from the church and the links that universities had to the established church. And then you have links coming from the state, from government. And now we're in a very new moment, which I think Eric's been identifying and trying to quantify in a very good way, actually looking at the threats that come from within institutions themselves, from fellow academics, and as we know, sometimes actually from students. And I take my hat off to Eric, because I do think this is something that clearly is going on, and it is something that is incredibly difficult to try and quantify. To kind of jump back a little bit then to the point about the left and right, as you say, I mean, I certainly don't identify myself as being on the right, but I think it's quite a while since I've identified myself as being on the left as well. I think not just in universities, but in wider society, these issues, these labels have become very complicated nowadays. So I think it's perhaps less helpful to think in terms of left and right, and more helpful to perhaps look at individual issues. So certainly when it came to Brexit, I was working in a university at the time of the referendum, and I voted Brexit. And that, in the eyes of many people, would automatically have me labelled as being right on the right. But that's something I would deny. I think it was very interesting in universities at that time, when you go back to 2015, 2016, that there obviously... it became very obvious for a few months exactly what the culture was and how the your awareness of what the political culture was dictating. So I think it was very, very, well, not very subtle, that would be a bit of a lie, but it wasn't a kind of dictate that came down, although sometimes this did actually happen. You didn't get an email saying you must vote Remain or you must not speak critically and you must not speak out in support of Brexit. But what you did notice was that suddenly even quite quiet academics who wouldn't consider themselves to be politically active would put posters on their door, for example, or have little flags sitting in a pencil pot on their desk with the EU stars on. And you'd have a very casual atmosphere of people making jokes about thick Brexiteers or racist Brexit voters. And it was in the posters and the flags and the badges and the jokes and the lunchtime conversations that you became aware that you were very, very much in a minority if you backed Brexit. And I think if that was what it was like for me, I think for students and for prospective students, you wouldn't have to spend more than 5 minutes on a campus before you would become very aware of this dominant position, if you like, even though it may not have been an institutionally ascribed view, you very quickly picked up that this was what almost everyone thought, and that to say something different, to challenge this, certainly required a great deal of bravery. And exactly as Eric alludes to, the far easier position was just to decide to self-censor and just not have a conversation about Brexit when you became aware that you thought something different to everybody else.
Yeah, I remember at university myself, it was more, you know, it wasn't that you weren't allowed to say what you thought, but there was a sort of just an assumption in the room that everyone agreed on certain things, be that the European Union or immigration or I don't know, left-wing politics in another respect, which is hard to fight back against when you're in the minority. Radomir, I remember you wrote an article for The Spectator where you compared Bucharest with Cambridge University in terms of a freedom of speech. Are there international comparisons that we can look to as places that are doing this better than we are?
Yeah, there are. Although I must say, I think this is a growing problem across the Western world in general. Before I get onto that, I mean, I'd just like to pick up on something that Joanna said about there's probably never been a golden age of free speech in universities, and there's always been a problem of different forms with censorship. I absolutely agree with that. But I think what, not just my experience at Cambridge, many people's experiences at top-flight universities in this country demonstrates is that I think it's particularly acute now. And this kind of gets to the nub for me about why we're having this discussion about universities, which is that if you consider what's the purpose of a university, the telos of a university, if you like, is the truth. It's getting to the truth. And therefore, if you develop a culture of censorship and self-censorship in universities in particular, it's liable to be particularly harmful for that telos and then a knock on culture in general. Eric mentioned J.S. Mill, and there's an excellent J.S. Mill quote on this. That goes, if the opinion is right, they, he's talking about the human race, are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error. So I think what we're talking about really is, if you lose free speech, if you lose that culture of free speech in universities, you deprive students and academics of a part of what rational inquiry is and a part of what being capable of rational inquiry is. And we are losing that in some ways in our universities, particularly in social science departments. Science is another question that we can come on to. That for me means that actually the Enlightenment itself is in many ways under threat, and I think is starting to die as a culture in universities, and what that means for our culture broadly, for our society, and ultimately for our democracy, I think is tremendously dangerous. To get back to the particular question, I mentioned in this article in The Spectator that I gave a lecture, a pro-Brexit lecture, to a university-organized conference in Bucharest, in Romania, in the autumn. And then I attempted to give the same lecture to a student society at Cambridge and was told, due to reasons of the controversy of this this subject, that wouldn't be possible. I suppose that qualifies as a no-platforming incident. I wouldn't say that over generations there's been a tradition of free speech in Eastern Europe, for example, that's been better than ours for obvious reasons before 1989. But I think part of the reaction to the experience of hard Marxism in parts of Eastern Europe, I know there are some governments in Eastern Europe that are creating their own problems for free speech, but in parts of Eastern Europe is that people are more culturally hostile now to some infractions of free speech, whereas over a couple of generations in the UK, definitely in the English world in general, to some extent in Western Europe, people have, like the frog in the water that's being gradually heated up, got used to a culture of free speech denial. So I think that UK universities need to wake up rather quickly to why they are in business, why they are respected in the world, and how they could lose that if they do not make greater efforts to preserve free speech.
Could I just respond to some of that, Emily?
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Thank you. Looking at the first part of what you were saying there, Radomir, about the truth and the mission of the university being a truth-seeking institution, I'm just concerned that we get this the right way round, because I think historically, you're right, that was the mission of the university. And if that was still the mission of the university, we could see how that would be threatened by students and academics trying to restrict free speech. Perhaps I'm being unduly pessimistic here, but I think it's actually the other way around. I think universities have lost this truth-seeking mission and have lost it a long time ago, a long time, in fact, before the academic and student threats to free speech started appearing on the scene. So when I have conversations with people in academia and talk about the university as a truth-seeking, as an academic mission being to seek the truth, I'm immediately questioned. People will say, of course there is no truth. What do you mean by the truth? We have multiple truths at best. That's all you can aim for, is multiple truths where people speak from different perspectives. People have their own standpoint, that speak from their own identity. And at best, we can hope to let this plurality of truths emerge in the world. But even then, it's only ever a relativistic and a questionable truth. And I think it's because that has been accepted first that then suddenly free speech doesn't seem important anymore. Why would you defend free speech and academic freedom if you have no aim of trying to arrive at the truth? All you want to do is let multiple voices speak out, and your understanding of those voices is very much associated with power. And power comes back to identity and your position in society, in which case, actually shutting down powerful voices and letting, in theory, less powerful voices emerge is considered to be a better way at arriving at multiple truths.
Eric, would you agree with that analysis, that we've lost the purpose of academia, the purpose of universities?
Well, I think that's right. Although I think that, you know, again, it depends where you look. So for the vast majority of academics who are just looking at something small, they might be looking at butterflies or pottery or something that isn't particularly contentious. Actually, they can pursue truth in their own way, many of them can, without harm. I think what we're really talking about is anything that touches on the third rails of the contemporary cultural left. That's race number one, then gender and sexuality. Anything that can be framed in those terms is really being censored in a way, mainly self-censored. But and so what we're not, what we, where we're not seeing the progress of knowledge is in anything that is in any way associated with those areas, which is actually a substantial part of the social sciences and humanities, since those topics are heavily researched. And I happen to be in a field, study of nationalism and ethnicity and national identity, that's very much implicated in that. And so what happens, or what tends to happen, Arthur Sakamoto had a good a podcast, I think, on the Heterodox Academy site, where he says it's just the case that if you go against the orthodoxy, you won't get published, or it's very difficult to get published, so you just don't, you decide not to publish that kind of a paper. And in his case, showing that Asian Americans didn't experience discrimination, that was an almost impossible message to deliver in sociology. And that's the kind of example that we see, because it's what we, and just coming back to the data in the report, I mean, what you see in terms of a threat is that if we look at younger academics versus older academics, the share actually of right-wing and conservative academics isn't really much different between young and old. Even in the social sciences and humanities, you've still got your, whatever it is, 5% to 10% conservative academic. The big difference, however, is between the center and center left and the far left. So younger academics are more likely to be far left. Older academics are more likely to be center left. Well, sorry, what I should say is there's a higher percentage of far left amongst your younger academics. The second thing you see is there is a, when we look at the, if you like, the tension between cultural egalitarianism, emotional safety, social justice, whatever we want to call it, and support for academic freedom, freedom of expression, that balance is tilted more towards the social justice end amongst younger academics. And so again, that would suggest we've got a looming problem that's only going to get worse. And it's already the case that academics as a whole tend to lean more towards social justice than the population. I'll just quote you, I mean, just to look at something that wasn't in the report, there's a question on YouGov's profile data set, thinking about political correctness, are you generally in favor of it? It protects against discrimination, or against it, it stifles freedom of speech. In the UK public, it's 37% in favor of political correctness, 47% against. Amongst the academics in the sample, 64% in favor of political correctness against, 31% against. And amongst current social science humanities academics, 76% favor that political correctness statement against, 20% who oppose it. So that gives you kind of a flavor just in terms of that question. But when you actually ask about dismissal, dismissing staff doing controversial research on immigration, on empire, on gender, actually there's very low support. And this was an encouraging sign. Only about 1 in 10 academics would favor dismissing and doing that research. However, about 50% of them were torn, and they were unsure whether they opposed that. And it's actually amongst the younger academics that we find greater support for dismissal. So it is, I would submit to you, a growing issue. And of course, it's a growing issue in the wider society, as we saw with the Harper's letter and what we see in tech and the media. This is no longer just confined to universities, but reflects the broader culture. And this is one of the reasons why I think we've got to address the problem. It's not just the universities. They influence a much wider stratum of opinion and threaten freedom, expressive freedom, at a much broader level than just on campus.
Yeah. Go on, Joanna.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm too enthusiastic to put in here. I agree with Eric that there is a generational element to this. And I think in some ways that's far more interesting than looking at it through a left-right prism, because it seems to me that one group that is particularly facing a huge amount of censorship on campus nowadays are gender critical feminists. So the feminists who argue that there is a biological reality to being a woman, that being female means something in terms terms of chromosomes and hormones and genitalia, and it's not being a woman's not just a state of mind, but the vast majority of those feminists who are massively being censored would consider themselves to be on the left. You know, they are left-wing feminists. That most of them do happen to be of a slightly older generation than the younger, in more intersectional, more social justice. I think, Eric, you know, that's absolutely the right word to use there, feminist. But I'm pushing away, I guess, from the left-right divide on this issue. I'm not sure how helpful that is. And just to kind of move the discussion on a little bit here, I think where this becomes a problem for all academics, irrespective of their discipline, is that people who are in managerial positions in universities nowadays take some of these social justice principles and codify them as institutional values. So when you look at value statements such as mission statements, they include references to inclusivity, to diversity, often to sustainability. And these statements appear very generic and very bland. They appear to be kind of motherhood and apple pie type statements that give us all warm fuzzies and we can all buy into. But they're actually very politicized. They actually are very contentious values that just seem to be apolitical to people who blindly agree with them. But when you start unpicking what's meant by inclusion and diversity and sustainability, you actually have some very political concepts around gender, for example, gender identity, around the green movement, often aligned with things like Extinction Rebellion, in terms of diversity, often very happy to align with movements like the Black Lives Matter movement. But I think when these become institutional values, they become far harder for everyone to challenge them. And your job does very directly then come to be seen as being on the line if you're in breach of institutional values, irrespective of however wonderful your research might be in whichever disciplinary area you're working in.
I'd just like to pick up on this question of biological reality that Joanna mentioned, because I think partly for this reason, the pottery and butterfly scholars that Eric mentioned earlier may actually now be under threat. It may be somewhat worse than you say, because this phenomenon that, again, Joanna mentioned of postmodernism, really, since the 1960s, marching through the universities and taking apart the central idea of truth. I think that's absolutely right, and that's had a huge impact. But the result of that is that if anybody now stands up for fundamental truths or what they view as biological facts, and that they can demonstrate to be facts, is regarded precisely as somebody who is simply trying to assert power over others. And actually the impact of that on hard science is starting to become clear, because scientific inquiry is now being described as a Western concept, a colonial concept, again, inevitably a form of power play, and you have serious hard science journals now responding to this, and in one case saying they won't publish serious peer-reviewed articles that discuss innate brain differences, biological brain differences between men and women. So that's a very serious inroad on our capacity to debate and inquire as a society.
That's dreadful. I mean, putting this to everyone. Sorry, Eric, you can come in after. I just want to put this one question just before we move on to how to fix it. In your ideal world, would there be no limits at all to academic freedom? Is that the ideal?
Well, I think that is the ideal, unless, I mean, I think I would like to see the law apply, so the limits should be the law.
Okay.
So if, of course, what you're doing in academic terms is going to lead to, you know, somebody being killed imminently, you know, if you're inciting violence, etc., then no, that would be the limit, I think, rather than the kinds of arbitrarily imposed limits that are actually, in fact, violating the law on academic freedom and free speech that are currently being enforced in the university sector. So all I would ask for is respect the law and apply the law, and that's all we've said in the report, is we want universities to essentially obey the law.
Joanna, what's your thoughts on that? Should there be any restrictions?
Well, no, there shouldn't be any restrictions on academic freedom whatsoever. I think there are two problems, though. One is that the very setup of academia, the structures that we've relied upon for decades now, actually enable the kind of subtle threats to academic freedom that we've been talking about throughout. So, for example, I'm thinking of, in particular, the peer review process. So in order to get a promoted position within an institution or to have an article published, you submit the article to your peers who will review and give comment on that. And this, in an ideal world, is supposed to be a fail-safe mechanism of quality assurance, of making sure that truth is the aim and good research makes it through, good researchers become promoted and become successful. Unfortunately, when we have the kind of climate that we've been talking about so far, peer review works in exactly the opposite way. It works to limit what people can say. It works to restrict certain viewpoints from emerging. And the real problem there then is, how do you keep the good things of peer review? How do you keep a quality assurance mechanism? How do we sort the good research from the bad research, whilst at the same time allowing free speech to emerge? I agree with Eric that we want free speech within the law, absolutely. I think I'd go actually a little bit further than that, because when you look at the direction in which the law is heading, particularly around hate speech legislation and the whole concept of almost like a hate thought crime, it seems to me, then I think the law needs to be changed as well, because the law can actually act as a huge impediment on free speech. And also, I think this operates in other ways as well that have a particular impact on universities. And I think we do need to ask questions about the PREVENT strategy and the way that that hands a certain power over to universities to restrict speakers. And we might argue, for all good reasons, that we want certain speakers not to be allowed on campus. But then we need to question ourselves, are we applying a double standard here? Are we saying we want all the kinds of speakers who we agree with to be allowed to speak, but we don't want others because we see them as being too dangerous or we don't agree with what they're going to say? So yeah, free speech within the law, but question hate speech legislation, overturn the PREVENT duty, and also have a look at how peer review is now working within institutions.
I just want to add, though, to that, which I agree with completely, is this: the way in which the radical left activists, and this is a very powerful network that is within the university, but also links to activists on Twitter and outside, a pressure group that essentially has the universities over a barrel and is able to exert its will, and they do so through powerful internal mechanisms. So, for example, you can think of something like ethics committees. You need to get approval from your ethics committee before your research can proceed. And one of the tactics sometimes of the radical left is to try and go after you to say, oh, you didn't get ethics approval, or if you did, question that approval. Or perhaps on the ethics committee, a radical activist can try and prevent your research from going ahead. So there are all of these, and then institutionally, if your research is being reviewed by your line manager, they have an impact, or perhaps promotion committees have. So at all of these levels within the university, things you don't see are going on, which represent threats to academic freedom, subtle ways in which people's biases can actually play out through the power they hold. They may not actually be able to fire you, but they can certainly prevent you from advancing, and that can be enough of an incentive for you to shut up and get in line.
Yeah, I didn't quite realise the extent to, well, the amount of number of hoops you have to jump through before you can get a paper published. It's always devastating to think of how much research is just out there left in draft form that could have been out to the world but has been stopped. So moving on to how we can fix this. Firstly, are there universities that are doing this better? Are there universities that are fostering real debate, supporting dissenting voices? Which institutions are doing well? And if you do believe that not is all lost, that all is not lost, what recommendations would you make? I know in Eric's paper, he recommends that the government introduce a bill.
Yeah, so we recommend the government introduced something called an academic freedom bill. They've already put academic freedom in their manifesto, which is good, but of course we've had a lot of lip service paid over the years, particularly by conservative governments, to academic freedom. It's very important that you actually have enforcement mechanisms and teeth. It's not enough to have a nice Chicago statement. All universities say, yeah, we support free speech, but when it conflicts with emotional safety, they drop the free speech part, right? Or when it conflicts with quote-unquote reputational damage, they drop the free speech part. So it's very important that the exact balance between, you know, when can free speech be abridged exactly with examples. That's what we need, tight definitions of terms like racism, etc., that allow no wiggle room for universities to essentially say, oh, well, but this is a violation in the name of equality, right? So what we have with the Academic Freedom Bill is that it would set up the position of director for academic freedom on the Office for Students, which would then have the role of hearing any complaints of people who feel their academic freedom has been violated. I think that would have a massive effect because right now universities routinely can haul you into committees. Left activists will bombard university Twitter feeds to get you in trouble, to raise complaints which are automatically relayed to you. It's happened to me on a number of occasions. You get the email from the senior manager that says there's been a complaint against you, blah, 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 blah. And it just gives you a chill effect. Those emails should just not happen. Those complaints should be blocked at the door if they don't meet a threshold. That's number one. So you should be able to essentially, under this system, you can go around your university, complain directly to the director, get away from your university. That's the most important thing because universities themselves have been corrupted by this pressure group and they're not going to be able to fix themselves. Second thing is you have an appeals process. Universities need to be depoliticized, so no official communications should carry any political biases. And that's another thing that just partly in terms of encouraging viewpoint diversity and removing the political discrimination that exists, that would be an important message. Now, I think there are other things that could be done. But again, this position, finally, of the director for academic freedom would be that universities would have to submit a report outlining all of the complaints that have occurred through the year, the measures that have been taken, the discipline, any disciplinary actions, because universities use these disciplinary mechanisms essentially to knock people into line. So those would be scrutinized and the power to both sue and fine universities. So every year universities would be under the gun to show that they were improving or they're going to be fined. I think that level, that is what's required actually to get them to behave. And once you do that, I think actually that will go a long way towards curing this climate of fear. Because if someone says, well, I can always appeal to the ombudsman if I feel my freedom is violated, I can't be fired by this arbitrary kangaroo court in my university. Right now, those controls do not exist. Universities can largely do what they want unless you sue them. That has to be changed.
Radomir, do you agree? Can legislation help fix this problem? As a free marketeer, does this state intervention worry you?
Yeah, it's a very good question. On principle, it does to an extent, because of course, if we're interested in freedoms, and we all are, as well as freedom of speech, we should be interested in freedom of association. And so in my sort of academic utopia, I could conjure up an image of a competing marketplace of different universities where if people are allowed to hire and fire freely, people could create hard Marxist university, people could have libertarian U up the road. And there'd be this wonderful universe in this country of genuine academic competition and the competition of the marketplace of ideas. That said, first, Eric is absolutely right that this is urgent and this is a crisis and this has gone so far that probably justifies legislation. I think the ideas he's described are very good. But also, because we don't have that competing marketplace of private universities and so on, taxpayers' money is being spent on this. And so government, I think, can reasonably say, well, if you want continuing flow of money from the state, you shouldn't be acting against the interests of the state writ large as a democracy. So yes, I do think there's a case for some intervention. That said, this is also urgent for civil society, and I think civil society needs to see its role more, and I include philanthropists in this, as setting up competing mechanisms, whether it's new research councils, whether it's funding new parts of universities, funding think tanks. Of course, everybody should join the Free Speech Union, that goes without saying, but there is a very, very big role for civil society in this. Finally, I think government intervention actually has to go further than simply in the universities, because the universities now, for so long, have been churning out graduates whose culture, whose way of thinking is so far removed from pro-free speech that they think they are doing society a favour by proposing the censorship of the lyrics to Rule Britannia at last night of Proms. So really, there needs to be wider-ranging reform by government of state-linked institutions than simply in the universities, in order to then solve the problem in the universities that they reinforce.
Joanna, do you agree with Eric and Radomir, or do you think this needs to come from the bottom up?
So I'm in a very strange position here, because I think out of everybody on the panel today, I'm probably the least free marketeer-y type of person. I'm not an advocate of free markets. I mean, I'm not particularly opposed to free markets, but it's never been a hill I would die upon. And yet I think I'm the most opposed to having government regulation of higher education in to legislate for academic freedom, if you like, or having a kind of academic freedom directorate, for a number of reasons, a few philosophical, but primarily pragmatic. So the philosophical reason is I do think that institutional autonomy is incredibly important. I don't think we necessarily have it so much at the moment, but as an aspiration and as something that we should want to have, then I think institutional autonomy and having the freedom to criticise the state in all matters is vitally important if we're to sustain a culture of academic freedom in the long run. But far more pragmatically, I just don't think you can legislate for academic freedom. I think you can't make people like you is, I guess, the basis of what I think here. You can't make people have lunch with you, or actually you probably can make people have lunch with you, but you can't make them have a nice conversation. You can't make them agree with what you're saying or be more sympathetic towards your views. I think the danger is that we give some of the people who are most chomping at the bit to restrict academic freedom at the moment, we give them ammunition, we allow them to perceive of themselves as victims of government control. We allow them to say, look, you have this interfering state on your side, we're just the little people, kind of pushing back and sticking up for minority perspectives. And I don't think these people need to be given that status or any ammunition to help them find that status at all. But like I said, I think my bigger point here is just that this is such a broader cultural issue that Radomir kind of used the word, you know, we can have this legislation. Sorry, Radomir, I'm paraphrasing you most terribly here, but then they will have to behave. But I think the problems are so deep and so deeply ingrained in the culture of an institution that behaving is seen by university bureaucrats and managers and a great deal of academics. Behaving is sticking up for and defending the rights of transgender people or supporting Black Lives Matter. You know, this is how you behave. That's how being good, being a good academic citizen is seen. So the more we kind of crack the whip and say you must behave, either they are able to present themselves as persecuted, yeah, or they just say, well, yes, we'll carry on doing even more of what we're doing in order to be...
Eric and then Radomir.
I guess I would really strongly, very strongly disagree with that. And I mean, if you look at attempts by Heterodox Academy and others to go this route of social reform from below, I mean, it's just not worked. Because we have two problems. One is the direction of the conversation in society. And I actually think if you look at the media, there's actually pretty good, or social media, there's actually pretty good pushback and resistance to wokeness and to threats to free speech. That's where, in some ways, the situation is most positive. It's inside institutions that, in fact, the social currents can't make progress because these institutions are, in many ways, controlled by a pressure group that can use taboos to magnify their power within institutions. So you have to break those institutions by men. And all we're asking for is obey the law. So these, and just to use an example, I mean, in the early 1960s, the American, the federal government in the United States basically told Southern universities they had to desegregate. Now, you could say, well, they should have institutional autonomy. If they want to be segregated, they can be segregated. But actually, there are times when you actually have to curb institutional autonomy to protect individual liberty. And that is an example of where you the federal government actually had to move in and control the universities in order to permit desegregation and freedom to take place. And I think we're in a very, very similar situation. Or similarly, when you have a school that might be taken over by a group of religious fanatics, government has to put the school into special measures. This is a very similar situation. To protect individual liberty, you have to curb institutional autonomy. Institutional autonomy, in my view, is secondary to individual liberty. Now, of course, it is always possible the government could abuse its power, but we have a I would rather trust a democracy to make that decision, the public, than a clique of people who happen to have power in an institution. So I think it is important. This is one of those instances where the state has to move in to protect individual liberty against institutional power. The other thing, too, is that you have these founder effects, right? So we don't have a freewheeling free market. We actually have institutions that were founded, and because of these legacy effects, those legacy effects are very powerful. Those institutions control a lot of funding and resources, and you're not going to create a free market that will create new forms of universe. I just don't think it's going to happen. It's like creating a new Google. They are simply got too many, there's too much of a network effect. They're too established. So you've got to try, I think, to get into these institutions and reform them. And all we're saying is, let's bring democracy and the law to bear on these institutions.
But to come back on that.
Sorry, one second, Joe.
Eric, I love your confidence in the state, and I love your confidence in the law. Unfortunately, I'm very concerned about police going knocking on people's doors for sending tweets that have been considered to be transphobic, and essentially questioning people and taking them all the way through to the courts for essentially thought crimes. And if the police can do that to your average citizen sitting at home with their iPad sending tweets of an evening, then I'm afraid I just don't have confidence in that same legal system and same state to bring academic freedom to universities.
Well, but I think that the solution there is that, in fact, you reform the state and the law to reflect the values that you want. I don't think you get rid of the police or you get rid of the law. The idea is that, you know, you have to have these things, but they have to reflect the values of the population.
Yeah.
If you were to simply allow these, for example, if you take the Supreme Court in the United States, which has political input, but if judges happen to be all liberal, let's say, and want to impose their values on a population, I think that's a much worse solution than having the state interfere in the selection of Supreme Court judges to make sure they reflect the balance of values in the population. So this is a situation where actually politicization is important to actually help to an institution to reflect the values of society rather than the values of the groups that have captured it or who inhabit it.
Radame, I'll let you have the last word on that. What's your view?
So I do have to pick up on this allegation that I want the government to regulate people to the extent that they should tell them to behave. Not guilty. What I do suggest is that we can ask, can the government say, we're happy for taxpayers' money to be spent on scholars infringing the rights of free speech to others, and that's where the government intervention should come in, that if scholars want to continue to be funded to research and to teach, they shouldn't tell other scholars how to behave. So that's the kind of intervention I'm looking at. Absolutely, the growing arena of the policing of thought crimes is a huge threat to our society. I think universities have involved themselves in that broadly, in accusing colleagues and accusing their staff of thought crimes. And this point that Eric made about there is greater support among scholars for political correctness than there is among the population, a considerable difference actually, I think is exactly why we have to see action to return universities to what are society's values, society's democratic values, because alarmingly, what that shows is that the man on the street who is less inclined towards political correctness, in that way has a better idea of what it means to be a scholar, which is searching for truths, than scholars.
Yeah.
So that, to me, says this is an urgent situation.
Well, on that note, unless there are any further comments to finish, I'd like to thank you all for joining me today. That was a really good discussion, and there was quite a lot of debate there. So thanks so much for joining. That was really, really interesting for me, and I'm sure will be for our YouTube watchers and on Twitter and elsewhere.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please do leave a comment and subscribe. You can also check out the video version over on our YouTube channel. And do sign up to our weekly newsletter. Just head over to the IEA website to register.